Hello and welcome back, everyone. This is the Boiled Leather Audio Hour with Stefan Sasse and Shorty Collins. I'm Stefan, and I am an author at the Tower of the Hand, and since a little bit of time, at the nerdstreamera.blogspot.com, my personal blog, so check it out. And with me, as always, is...
Shorty Collins. Hi, everybody. Good to be back with you. Yes, I am the founder of BoiledLeather.com, which is the... A Song of Ice and Fire blog, where you probably found this podcast. I also write about Game of Thrones and various other prestigious television programs for Rolling Stone, and I co-wrote the annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia and Anne Grohl for the Subtext iPad app. And Stefan told me that there was no need for me to do this, but I'd like to apologize to everybody for the lengthy delay between our last installment and this one, which is entirely my fault for various reasons of scheduling and technical difficulties and just generally being in a glass case of emotion for the last couple months. I've had something of a rough patch. So, but I'm glad to be back with you and chit-chatting about this delightful book series. So thanks for tuning back in, hopefully, if you're out there. We really have no idea at this point, actually. We could be just screaming into the void, which hopefully we're not doing.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
That got real deep and real heavy all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah. I'm totally sorrowful. And now my heart is heavy. So let's launch into our topic today. We are continuing our series on the women of Ice and Fire. And our topic of today are Asha and Brienne, or Brienne, or however you want to pronounce her.
Potato.
Yeah, exactly. And our first issue will be Brienne. So the thing about Brienne is, in my book, that she tries, so it's my hypothesis, so to speak, she tries to... embrace a role model that is connotated with being a male in the world of Ice and Fire. She tries to be a knight, basically, but in Westeros, a knight has to be male. He can't be female. There is no title for her, which becomes apparent when people call her Sir, which she also dislikes because it has this male connotation in it. And she is generally very uncomfortable in her role, but she also can't accept what is normally attributed to women. Unlike Cersei Lannister, for example, she just doesn't like the limitations, but she embraces the role easily enough. But Brienne accepts the limitations, but she doesn't accept the role. So this is a rather interesting thing, and it gets real hard on her. So what do you think about it?
I'm glad you brought up Cersei, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we've ever heard Brienne wish that she were a man the way Cersei often does. You know, I mean, that's a common thing with Cersei, to regret the situation that she's in her life, you know, the sort of twist of fate that allowed her to be born a woman rather than a man, and all the way her life would have been different, you know, had she been in Jaime's shoes, or in Jaime's genitals, if you will. It's interesting to me that I don't think we've ever really heard Brienne think in that way. And to me, that's what makes Brienne one of the most modern feeling characters, despite the fact that she is so singularly devoted to the code of chivalry and conduct of knights, you know, which is obviously antiquated and old fashioned. But as a person, like, she's not, you know, it just takes a great deal of personal courage to power through societal disapproval and her own misery in her situation, but and still be the way that she is, because she just can't be any other way. She does, you know, she regrets that she is this way. It's made her life very difficult, and I know she feels that she's disappointed people that care about her, but she you know, she, Brienne is Brienne, and that's pretty compelling to me.
Yeah, she's certainly not a revolutionary, not like Jon or Daenerys are, who is out there to turn the social order upside down. She accepts that there are nobles and there are common people. She also accepts for the most part that there are these male and female role models. She just doesn't think that she fits. And this is a problem for her because I think deep in her heart she would like to fit. But she simply doesn't. She is a man in the body of a woman, and she doesn't really cope with that. It is not expected. There is no precedent for it. You simply have no space in normal Westerosi life where you can live out such a problem. Same would be true if you would be a man with a rather female attitude. You would be laughed at as gay or effeminate and stuff like that. No, people would bully you and you would most likely die an early and ugly death in some alley.
Right.
I mean, look at Saturn at the wall, who is in a similar situation, and he is rather male, but he just looks the part, and he was a whore before, and he gets really much abuse for it. And so Brienne, she has the same problem, basically. There is no place for people like her because the expectations of society are too strict. But she doesn't really challenge them in a way.
Right.
She would never go around and encourage anyone to do the same thing as she did.
No, because I think she clings to that that code of conduct as sort of a steadying influence in a life that has been really tumultuous because of her, you know, because of her size and because of her interests and because of where her skills lie. You know, so much of her life has been chaos that, you know, I think that in addition to whatever genuine moral and philosophical considerations she brings to her conduct as a sort of unofficial knight, that conduct also just provides something of a security blanket that enables her life to have a sort of a true north by which to steer, since she doesn't have recourse to the strict gender roles that the whole rest of the society has. I do want to say, you know, when we talk about her being a man trapped in a woman's body or a manly body of a woman, I don't know, she's not transgendered, right? Like, there's no sense that she feels male.
No, not at all.
And, you know, I mean, she's... You know, she is not interested in being a proper lady because it just makes her miserable. It's not like Arya also, where she's just kind of rebelling. She's not a rebel. Not even, you know, let alone she's not a revolutionary like Jon or Dany. She's not even a rebel like Arya. She just is the way she is. But, you know, she's still definitely a heterosexual woman who was in love with Renly. And, you know, so... you know, and who thinks of herself as a woman and identifies as, you know, and identifies as a heterosexual woman, which again is what makes her, you know, just a very unique and compelling figure to me because, you know, I think that since you're not dealing with these sort of really core issues of gender identity, you can look at Brienne simply as, you know, someone who doesn't fit in, you know, in a way that's maybe a little bit tougher to do with someone like Jon, who feels that he doesn't fit in, but still lives this life of, you know, tremendous privilege and has, you know, has sort of like an emo feel to him. Like, there's nothing, Brienne doesn't feel emo, despite the fact that she's much more miserable than Jon. You know, she feels like someone that I think we can all relate to when our lives have just taken us to a place where we're unhappy because who we are, we can't make the puzzle piece that is us fit in the space available on the puzzle. You know, I don't know. I mean, then, you know, that's just me. You know, I'm sure people who do have, you know, actual transgendered people, you know, maybe do approach Brienne from that direction, and I'm sure get something, you know, very satisfying out of it. But for me, just as a normal run-of-the-mill person who felt like he didn't fit in from time to time, that's what I connect with Brienne.
Yeah. To come back to the question of sexuality, she's almost painfully aware of her own sexuality. It was really, as you said, not a transgender issue, or she's not trans West Side or something like that. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want to go into bed with another woman or anything in, let's say, gross. She is a woman. She knows she is one. And she also has the needs of a woman. She just suppresses them very well.
Yeah.
And this is because of a very... Not because she would be ashamed of being a woman. She is ashamed of being an ugly woman. She's painfully pragmatic. She knows what will happen if she approaches a man. She knows what happens when she tries to flirt or to do anything normal women that don't look exactly like her are doing. So she has been reproached so often and hurt so often in the process that she doesn't even try anymore. She is chastised because she simply can't do anything else. She doesn't want to try anymore. And that makes her deeply suspicious because of her previous experiences. I mean, the knight in Feast for Crows, I just forgot the name, Sir Paleview, something like that, who tried to fool her in the past. The guys in Renly's camp who do this really, really bad bet on her and the virginity, which is really cruel thing to do. And not just because of the winning aspect, but because you are so made into an object. Your whole identity and personality is stolen from you in such a moment. And people like Red Ronnet, who run their mouths about you all the time, and everyone feels free to hurl insults at her without an end. Not even only the nobles, it's also common people who feel free to insult her, to mistreat her, just because she is a woman that does not fit in. It makes her an outsider, kind of an outcast. She would have a higher station than she really enjoys because of it.
Yeah, and that's another thing that feels very modern about Brienne to me, which is that she's just sort of the victim of run-of-the-mill sexual harassment. I think... When I think about her in Renly's camp and this bet that these creeps made to try and take her virginity, I think of street harassment a lot. I think of, women, in the city being catcalled as they walk from place to place, and just this sort of constant pervasive sense that you're being... strangers are insisting that you make yourself available for their... commentary and enjoyment, and also as a place to vent rage about unrelated issues, and it makes Brienne very sympathetic, and I think you brought up that she's ugly, and I think that's important too, because it's not just that she is a woman who identifies with a traditionally male role and wants to do traditionally male things in the world, and that's her only problem in terms of how people perceive her. She's ugly as sin, according to everybody, not just her. And that changes the equation, I think. We'll get to Asha. Asha's not necessarily drop-dead gorgeous, but it seems like people find Asha sexy. Because I guess she has a big nose, whatever. But if Asha were, hideous to look at, I think things would change for her somewhat. Her demeanor would certainly change, I would assume. The way people interact, the way men interact with her and women interact with her will change, and that's important too. Women feel pity for Brienne, they just feel, particularly, we see this mainly through Catelyn, just how bad she feels for this person who's so miserable, who looks the way she looks and is built the way she's built and has these skills and these interests that just do her no good in that society. So she's an object of pity, as well as derision and as well as, sort of sexual harassment. And that comes, a lot of that comes down to her looks, at least as much, if not more, than her size and, you know, her masculine interests and aspect.
Yeah, I think the most creepy thing about people treating her is still Randall Tarley, because how he interacts with her in Maidenpool, I think it is, or Duskendale, one of those, where he tells her that he expects her to be raped and he doesn't intend to do anything about it because he thinks she deserves it. This cold neglect that he enacts towards her, I find this very strong, much stronger than the pity or the mobbing and bullying that she is subject to. This really cold demeanor that Randall Tarley displays is, for me, is the hardest to take. I think she doesn't take it as hard as some other things hurled at her.
Yeah.
But in Tarley's case, I think that's the most harsh sentiment that is brought towards her. He doesn't acknowledge her as a person at all. For him, she's just a function. She is the daughter of Tarth, so he can't just dispose of her. But he doesn't accept her in any way. It is really, really creepy.
It is. And there's a great example of one of the roles that rape can play in the society, which is basically rape as justice, which I don't even think when we discussed this issue with Alyssa Rosenberg, you know, a few episodes ago, I'm not even sure that we brought that Randall Tarley came up, but just hearing you describe it now, it's really striking how, in his eyes, rape is the just price that Brienne will pay for failing to be the right kind of woman. You know, that's it's shocking, but I think it's very instructive as to how gender roles are viewed in this society and how the more extreme elements among people, the severity with which they treat deviations from those roles. And of course, Randall Tarley did the same thing to his own son, who he felt was too effeminate. You know, I don't think he threatened him with rape. I can't remember. But, you know, he horrifically physically abused and emotionally abused this kid for years because he was insufficiently macho. And so Brienne just is getting the other side of that coin. She's too macho for a woman. So, in his view, rape, you know, would be her just desserts, the way that Sam's just desserts were being chained to a wall and being bathed in, you know, Auroch's blood and you know, having your own father threaten to murder you out in the woods. Or, you know, and your choice is either that or exile and disinheritance. So Randall Tarley, who would have you know, a pretty good career in the Republican Party today, I think is very emblematic of the society's more problematic views of gender and sexuality. And yeah, it's really, really striking when you bring it up that way. That's you know, just for being who she is, that's something that she's forced to confront.
Yeah, it is really, really gross. And I mean, Brienne, she still has a good heart. She can connect to people. She is empathic. She has empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can see it when she is traveling with this priest, with the Septon, and he tells her about broken men and stuff. You can see how she relates. She takes these vows that knights do, especially about protection, very serious. I think it has to do with how she was treated. The promise of protection from men has never been fulfilled for her. Just another case of the trope that the knights are the real monsters in this world. And for her, the reaction is she has to fulfill them herself because they don't do it. I mean, in the beginning, she was willing to marry. She had, what, 3 or 4 suitors?
Yeah.
And it just didn't work out. And so she made this decision afterwards. She wasn't on this path from the beginning. She was disappointed in men several times
before
she decided to stop caring about them.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. It's not she's born this way in a lot of ways, but not in that particular way. It's the way the world has treated her that drove her to sort of give up on certain aspects of life that she would otherwise enjoy and may yet still get to. I mean, we'll see. Presuming she survives whatever's about to happen with Lady Stoneheart and Jaime, which I do presume. I think that the thing that Jaime has been good for her, the thing that Jaime has been good for her is rekindling, even if she can't admit it, rekindling the idea that she could fall in love with a man. That there might be someone who would treat her with respect, which is a weird thing to talk about with how Jaime treats her, because he's obviously insulting her all the time. But, he has a grudging respect for her that eventually is not even so grudging. I think seeing that happen in real time in front of her face is probably good for her. And also at the same time, I think her interactions with Pod and even with Heil Hunt are ultimately healthy for her, because the longer she's around these people, these men, or in Pod's case, a boy, and the longer they have to appreciate what she brings to the table as a person, as a warrior, as an example of how knights should behave despite not being one, appreciation starts to dawn in them, and I think recognition of that appreciation starts to dawn in her. And, a lot of life is just forming healthy relationships and being near people who appreciate you and being able to sense and internalize that appreciation. And I think the more time she spends with people, instead of self-isolating or instead of being isolated, the more she's forced by circumstance into close contact with these guys, the better it will be for her in the long run. Not that her self-worth, I don't want to give the sense that her self-worth is dependent on men appreciating her. That's not my point at all. Like, I think that she has a hard time appreciating herself because she's seen so little of that from other people. You saw the same thing with Catelyn to an extent. I think Catelyn was good for her. I think these dudes will be good for her too, ultimately, if things work out all right. Did that make any sense? I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, she definitely makes some acquaintances which really help her in many ways. And I think Catelyn is chief among them, because she gives her a kind of purpose that is not tied to a man who will never ever really treasure her in a way that she wants. Catelyn may pity her still, but she is, I think, the most gentlest persons that Brienne has been with, aside from her father.
Yeah.
And Podrick Payne, of course, too, because she can protect him. I mean, Podrick, he is so inept. He's so unable at everything. You really have to like him and to want to care for him. And his loyalty to her, which is just genuine. It is not because, like Heil Hunt, a loyalty that is driven by some objective that he hopes to accomplish. It is just because that's how he is. And I think that is really one good thing for her. And once she realizes how Jaime views her, that will be good for her too.
Yes.
I don't think, as a side note, that she will ever be happy together with Jaime or something, like some people are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Suggesting. But I guess these two, should they survive their encounter with Lady Stoneheart, which I pretty much hope, then they will develop a kind of relationship that will help them both.
Right. Yeah, I think, this is a sidetrack bit, but I think Jamie's very serious about keeping his oaths now. I don't think he will, forswear his vow of celibacy ever again with anybody. So it's hard for me to see a way in which he can live happily ever after in a romantic way with Brienne. I don't see him surviving the events of the book either. But I think they can have a genuine friendship. And depending on, I think we can all picture, like Dany taking the Iron Throne and having like a Queen's Guard that has men and women on it. And, if by some miracle Jaime does survive killing Cersei, which I assume he's going to be doing, they could end up on the Queen's Guard. I don't know. But yeah, I think that relationship will be good for them. I don't think, when I'm 64 situation with Brienne and Jaime is in the offing, but you don't necessarily need that for that relationship to be very healthy for the two of them, provided they survive this, which I think they will.
But. Yeah, very much hope so.
Yeah.
So I guess this would be the point where we leave Brienne behind and have a look at Asha, mm-hmm. because in many ways she's very similar to Brienne, and in many other ways she's totally not.
Yeah.
I think the most striking similarity between the two is that Asha also embraces this warrior personality. She is, I think, the only Ironborn woman. So it is not a culture thing, like in Dorne, for example.
Right.
She is really embracing it, and she's accepted in it, and she is happy and content in this role that she has taken up. She does a much better job at combining her feminine parts, and I'm not talking about body parts here, and her male parts within one coherent person. She is not thrown out of it like Brienne is all the time. No one would ever say to Asha, you're a captain, a woman, a captain, like they would say to Brienne and her being a knight. Asha simply displays a kind of self-consciousness and self-satisfaction with it that you don't doubt her. It just comes natural.
Yeah.
I mean, when Theon in A Clash of Kings, when he comes ashore and we meet her for the first time and we see her through his eyes, who are accustomed not to the Ironborn anymore, but to the Greenlands, it comes natural. It doesn't feel off like Brienne does from the get-go. It is one very natural thing about her, and I think this is it. That comes with it, how she behaves, that really sets her apart.
Yeah, and it's odd because, as you say, she's an exceptional figure in the Iron Islands, right? I mean, it's not Dorne, as you point out, where sort of more active female population is a common thing. And given how much, what an active rape culture the Iron Islands have, and how officially sanctioned and culturally sanctioned rape is, at least among foreign-born women that they conquer. It's a surprise that she's allowed to thrive the way she has been. And, I guess, it's so anomalous that I start to wonder, like, gee, is this really even that consistent on a writing level? Based on what we know about the Iron Islands. But I think the Ironborn, to a certain extent, are a meritocracy in a way that, the Greenland people are not. The Ironborn have lords and all that kind of thing. But, every man's a lord on his own ship. And, so that they're power, and that's the idea of power is more diffuse, even if its ultimate concentration on land is still concentrated in the hands of the nobility. And it's just such a warrior culture, and if you can prove yourself as a warrior, you've proven yourself. There's not really much, no one's going to be like, oh, well, yeah, but she's also a woman. She hits a glass ceiling eventually when she goes for the throne, but that takes a long time. And up until then, we get no sense that anyone's unhappy with what she's like and how she's behaved, I think. I can't recall. I bet Victarion's an asshole about it, but Victarion's an asshole. So that's not much of a surprise. And, you know, whether it's because of her own innate personality, whether it's because, in terms of her looks, she's more traditionally feminine than Brienne, whether it's because, you know, her family situation with her absent and insane mother and, you know, this brooding father and these dead brothers and this one missing brother gave her, you know, just through benign neglect, an opportunity to develop her own life and personality the way she wanted. Yeah, she's like a really vibrant, emotionally successful person. One of the most emotionally successful, you know, happy with her situation people that we meet in the entire series, I think.
Yeah.
And that's why I've been so hard. I mean, you know, readers of my Tumblr know that I have a history of being pretty hard on Asha, at least when Asha is presented to me as some, you know, great white hope for the future of the Iron Islands, because it's paradoxically, it is precisely her happiness with herself and her situation that makes her tougher for me to like, because ultimately her, you know, what she likes to do is kill people. She doesn't do it with the zeal or the sadism that a lot of people do. You know, but I do find that unpleasant, and I don't really mind saying that. But when you compare her to other Ironborn, or even just other Greyjoys, which I eventually realized that you probably should do, if you compare her to Victarion. Victarion's a monster, and has no idea, which makes it even worse. It makes it so much worse that he's not, you know, that he doesn't even get his jollies from it, the way Ramsay does, or the way one presumes Gregor does. Or even like the Hound, where it's like a compulsion and it's like the only way he can sort of cool the fires burning within him. You know, Victarion's just dog shit. And Asha's not like that. Whatever Asha's fault, she's not like that. So I wouldn't say that I've completely come around on Asha, but she's certainly a much, much, much healthier figure for that culture, yeah, than anybody else around there, and then you, and also healthier than you'd expect to exist at all.
Yeah, I totally agree on everything you said about Victarion and his relationship to Asha, because Victarion he's simply no, he's just so fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. I read his chapters in Dance with Dragons, Incredulous, and she said, how stupid can you be?
Yeah,
I mean, there is nothing going on in this head of his. I mean, Homer Simpson thinks more than this guy does. he just functions in a way he was programmed in one day, and he's going on since then, always the same program. Asha, yeah, she's definitely different. My objection would be the meritocracy part, because I think one very important thing about the development of Asha is that she is the darling of her daddy, especially after the failed rebellion, because she's the only child left to him, and she is a girl, but her father more or less ignores this fact. He doesn't brush it aside like, yeah, now you have to be a man and you have to grow up. He doesn't put her in clothes or tries to make her into a man at any kind, but he simply ignores the fact that the Ironborn normally wouldn't allow a woman to do what Asha does. It is, as you said, kind of a benign neglect.
Yeah.
And this is a unique and privileged position that Asha is in, because the other Ironborn, if they don't want to anger Balon Greyjoy, the great overlord of the Iron Islands, and who in his mind would want to do that, they also have to ignore Asha's sexuality. They simply have to try not to see it. It is an effort. At some kind, and after a time, people get used to it. It's Asha, after all.
Right.
But I don't think that someone, even if she was also so self-satisfied and content and driven like Asha would be in in the possible situation to aspire to the same thing, because this privilege that she enjoys is a very important part. I don't think she really realizes it, but it is spelled out to her in, I think, A Feast for Dragons by the reader of Harlow. It is him who tells her that Balon Greyjoy always kept her under his protective hand,
yeah,
and allowed her to do this stuff, but Victarion or anyone else wouldn't. And that is because why she has no chance.
Yeah.
The Ironborn still don't really get over it. She has a circle of fans, so to speak, people who really dig in her, who like her. She herself says half want to fuck her, half want to be like a father or brother to her.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who don't know her that intimately, they won't go for her, whatever her merits are, and there are considerable merits. I mean, her political plan is really sound. It is the best thing that the Ironborn ever will be able to get of future vision.
Yeah.
For them, that doesn't include fire and blood.
Right.
And these merits, they don't count anything. That's part to their culture, but part also, I think, because of the gender. Some of them ignore it because they are taught to do and told to do it. But I wouldn't go so far to say it's a meritocracy, because at the end of the day, you can rise to be a captain, like some of them did, the famous guys who started as normal raiders and at some point command their own ship. Mm-hmm. But never ever would some of these commanders aspire to be the king. Lineage and the noble ascendant, you still have to have the blood to gain the higher positions. You become the commander of the Iron Fleet not because you're the brightest star on the battlefield, but because you're the brother of Lord Greyjoy, right, as in Victarion's case.
Right.
And you can become king because you have the ancestry to go with it, and not because you are the best guy to go around.
Yeah, no, I mean, when I say it's a meritocracy, I'm just saying that, you know, I'm certainly not saying that it's a meritocracy the way, you know, I mean, obviously, and you don't think I'm saying this either, the way, like, a modern Western democracy is, in theory, a meritocracy. I'm talking about, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's just a matter of cultivating a habit of thought that doesn't necessarily exist in other aspects of society, in the same way that the Night's Watch, you know, yes, you are electing an absolute dictator, but you're electing him. You know what I mean? You may be electing someone who serves for life and has total authority over your life and death, but you are electing him, and you know that's a phenomenon that doesn't exist elsewhere in Westeros. And same here, like the ability of, you know, just, you know, even people who are thralls a generation or two, you know, their dad was a thrall or whatever, you know, can come to captain their own ship. People may not be crazy about them. But that's like a, you know, there's a vector for sort of improving your station in life that doesn't really exist in Westeros. I mean, in Westeros you can get knighted or your kid can become a squire. And, you know, we've talked about that. And I think that, you know, That is an available avenue of social mobility, but it's very small and it's completely dictated by, you know, by the nobility and by current knights. You know, whereas you know, it seems like if you're a good enough sailor and you can raise the dough, well, I don't know actually even how that works. Do you have to be able to? You have to be able to afford to buy or build a ship, right? I don't know how that would work in the Iron Islands. It's not something they've ever really discussed, is it?
I think you have to be a landholder of some kind, because else you simply can't afford it.
Yeah.
We have the shipwright that Theon and Asha talk about, Sigrid, and I don't think he works for
free. Right. Yeah.
So you have to pay him in some way, and for this you have to have lands or a wealthy merchant or do a good raid. But for a good raid, you need a ship. So
that's what I was. That was the variable I was missing. You can go and steal people's money and use that money. So, you know.
Yeah, but you need a ship to steal money.
That's a good point. Well, you could be
it's really a bit circular.
You could be on board someone else's ship and then, you know, and then do well enough in the raid. I don't know. But yeah, let's not oversell it, but it exists in a way that doesn't really exist
that's true.
In Westeros. That's all I was saying. And so you know, that sort of softens the ground a bit for a person like Asha to come along and people to be, you know, even though she's you know, she's a singular figure, the people's way of thinking has been opened to the idea that, you know, people can become, you know, their own little, they have their own little kingdom of the sea. And if it happens to be a woman, like, oh, that's kind of weird, but, well, all right, you know, she did it. You know, but as you point out, that only extends, that sort of penumbra only extends so far around Asha. You know, the people who know her on Pike, she seems to be very popular on Pike, you know.
Yeah.
That's very popular on Pike. And you know, part of that is her personality, part of that is her skill as a warrior and a sailor. Part of that is her dad, and her last name. But yeah, beyond, you know, as you go further out, and you know, when the king's mood happens, and you see that, you know, there's still big segments of the Iron Islands that are, you know, at best indifferent to her, you know, or skeptical, or just like, you got to be kidding. And yeah, you know, with Balin out of the picture, if when her uncles, you know, if whichever one of her uncles were to become king, you know, her station in life will be reduced very, very quickly. Which is what happens.
Yeah. And it is also interesting that she takes exile as an option, because yeah. She goes to Deepwood Mott, which is something like her castle now, and she tries to defend it. And when finally Stannis Baratheon's forces creep on Deepwood Mott and she leaves it, she is quickly determined to do this last stand in the woods, which brings us back to this aspect of her liking killing people, because she is a warrior at heart. I think it's not so much the killing point she enjoys,
right,
but this fight, the competition,
yes,
of life and death. She enjoys matching her own skills against someone else's, the tension of battle, all that goes with it.
Yeah.
Jaime does, for example.
Right. Right.
There are several characters who are just like her in that respect. She, since she is Ironborn, we don't have the knightly aspect of it, tourneys and stuff. But she has a knack for fighting in general. I think if she could recreate all these experiences without killing anyone, she would do it. But it's simply impossible, and she doesn't really care. Whoever loses this competition dies. That's just part of the game, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
And for her, in the Ironborn culture, you fight because you choose to fight, normally. I mean, the Ironborn are most of the time the attackers. So if you take part in a raid, you want to take part in a raid and you want to fight. And it is easy to forget that the guys you attack aren't exactly in the same mindset, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that's she's, yeah, she it is more of a sort of test your mettle thing than an enjoyment of inflicting suffering on other people. I mean, she goes out of her way to reduce that to the extent that she can. Not to the extent that she's like, you know, it's a bad idea to start wars of conquest. You know, it doesn't go that far for her. No. Any more than it goes that far, you know, like for people in the north to be like, you know what, maybe we shouldn't go kill tens of thousands of people to avenge one dude. Maybe that's a bad idea. You know, at no point do Asha's concerns for the well-being of others extend to, you know what, Dad, it's not a great idea to invade the North. That's mean. Yeah. But, like, I can't just get just laughing thinking of anybody saying anything like that in these books.
No, not at all.
No, but yeah, I mean, you know, she, you know, goes out of her way to protect women, to protect, what's her name? Lady Hornwood's kid? Baby? Right?
Oh my god, I don't know how it's called.
Yeah, you know, she's not a sadist.
No, that of course not. I think Victarion is to a point.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Victarion is sadistic, but doesn't even enjoy it. He's too stupid to realize and get something out of it, which makes him so uniquely horrifying to me. Like, I mean, Ramsay and, you know, Gregor, we really never get a look inside of Gregor, which is interesting. And I think, you know, you pull up that visor and there's nothing but thick black blood. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's I don't know what's going on inside of Gregor. I think the fact that he gets migraines is very interesting. I've always thought that. You know, that I don't know why I think that's interesting, but just a sort of a poetic level, like the idea that this giant of a man is just in intense physical agony all the time, and then also we know he goes around just killing anything he can get his hands on. I don't know, I feel like there's a connection there to inflict the agony he feels on other people. And Ramsay, obviously, just he could not be happier than to hurt people. Victarion, God knows what's going on with that guy. That's the thing. He's not just a creep. He's a drip. Like, he's just, like, so self-pitying and, like, can't even enjoy killing people. It's like, I mean, he enjoys fighting, though. That we get a good sense when they attack, you know, when he has that duel that ends up costing him his arm. You know, he does enjoy the process of fighting. In the same way that Asha does. But, like, he, you know, Asha's not going to dump prostitutes overboard. You know, Asha's not going to put a town to the sword. That's just not in Asha's makeup. I was going to say it's not in Asha's DNA, but it is in her DNA. But it's not in her as a person.
I think she's just more conscious about it. She knows why she does what she does, and she has thought about it. She is able to reflect about it, and she's not ashamed of it.
No,
that's this whole thing about her. She is very content with what she is. She has nothing that she wouldn't be happy about.
Right.
Like Eddard, for example, he doesn't enjoy the part of chopping people's head off, but it is his duty.
Right.
And Asha would think, yeah, let's chop his head off. He earned it.
Yeah.
So, and then afterwards, let's have a drink and tell a nice story. She just lives whatever she does. And that is also the case with her sexuality. She isn't interested in a concept like marriage because that would restrict her. So she also pushes back Tristain all the time because he would restrict her.
Right.
He is not the same free mind like she is. He's much more captured in concepts of society and of roles and expectations than she is. She basically does what she wants.
Yeah.
And would she hook up with someone like Tristain? She couldn't be that anymore. He would expect stuff of her, and she would have to comply at some level. And Jarl, on the other hand, he's just like her, I guess. I mean, we don't see a lot of him, but he certainly puts up with everything that she is mm-hmm. and that she does.
Yeah,
I think these two, they really fit each other.
Yes, and you know, the cool thing about Asha with, is it Tristain? The guy she you know, fooled around with when she was young, and now he's in love with her and she doesn't care. You know, Asha how can I put this? Today, in contemporary society, in all sorts of ways, you see a lot of just out-and-out panic and terror and rage by men over the idea that women could decide not to have sex with them, like, or to can decide who they want to have sex with and who they don't, who can make these decisions the same way guys do based on, like, who they think is attractive and what they think is will be a fun use of their time and emotion and body. Men are driven fucking crazy by this. Like, you see it with this whole idea of the friend zone and people complaining about being put in the friend zone, you know, as if, you know, like, how dare this woman not share my expectation that our emotional closeness entitles me to stick my dick in her, you know, and it's just, like, really fascinating and gross. And then, you know, here in America, one of our two political parties essentially decided to, like, use up valuable political oxygen to wage a war on the idea that women can have and enjoy sex without having to answer to a man about it, basically. You know, like calling Sandra Fluke, you know, who was, you know, advocating coverage of birth control by employer-provided health insurance, a slut. And it's like, the only way that makes any sense is if you find women asserting their sexual autonomy by demanding access to birth control, which enables them to have sex without being locked into childbirth, as inherently slutty. It's such a bizarre, gross viewpoint. And yeah. Asha refuses to put up with it at all. I mean, essentially, she's sticking that dude in the friend zone, and she don't give a fuck. And that's great. And I took a lot of ribbing when, you know, in one of my posts about Asha and what I found, you know, commendable about Asha. One of the things I said was, like, you know, she really enjoys sex. She has a very healthy and zesty sex life. And people thought I was basically being, you know, gross and sexist or whatever. But, like, I'm 100% sincere. There's not a lot of people in these books who assert their sexual autonomy, who think about their needs and their desires and take the steps necessary to fulfill them and don't feel guilty about it and don't abuse their sexual partner emotionally or physically in the pursuit of that fulfillment. There's very, very, very few people like that. Very few.
Interestingly enough, it brings us back to Doran, because I think that's the only place I have seen something like this with Arianne.
Yep.
We have to explore that in more detail at some point.
Yeah, I think so. And we would bring up, this came up in our conversation with Alyssa as well, I think, but, you know, the wildlings and,
yeah, that's
you know,
true.
They're you know, Ygritte, if Ygritte is in any way representative of wildling women, there is a sense that women are allowed to and encouraged to, you know, make their own choices as to, like, what guys they want to be with and you know, and to enjoy their sexuality. I mean, it's a wildling, you know, gender relations are all kinds of fucked up. Don't get me wrong. The whole stealing stuff. But, like, you know, women are raised to believe that they have a right to essentially kill someone that they don't want to have sex with. And men accept that, you know, like, it's interesting. But, like, you know, without those sort of far-flung geographical exceptions aside, like, Asha has a really healthy view of sexuality, and modern also, to keep coming back to that word, which comes up with these two women a lot. I really sincerely think that's commendable, and not just because, you know, woohoo, it's a lady and she likes to have sex, hotsy-totsy. Like, no, like, I think that's a genuinely forward-thinking and healthy way to treat that part of her life.
I got some heat for a similar sentiment once because Asha's sexuality is a bit gross in terms, because she likes this this rape role play. But I think it is just one of the ways in which she expresses herself. She doesn't enjoy a rape role play because she is a suppressed mind, or because she has to compensate something, or anything like this. What you would expect, perhaps, if you hear that someone is in for something like that. She just does it because she likes to. And she's really an interesting character in that way.
And I think, you know, the one thing that I think ties Asha and Brienne together, besides, you know, their sort of martial prowess, and that's how they've chosen to live their lives, is that they're kind of career women, aren't they? Like, you know, in a way that's rare among the women that we've seen in Westeros, their lives are what they do. You know, their careers. Their lives are not dedicated to childbirth, to getting married, to being, a lady and fulfilling those sort of roles and rights and obligations of, you know, a sort of a female member of the nobility. They want to carve out this autonomous niche for themselves where they're able to live their own life. You know, and just concentrate on their own needs and their own skills and their own desires and stuff, and like, and have a career, which is essentially closed off to all women, basically, almost everywhere, at least in the nobility. I mean, the small folk have to make a living. You know, so you have female innkeepers and female, well, prostitutes, that's, you know, kind of a, you know, female shopkeepers and things of that nature. Seamstresses and whatever, midwives, you know, so there, it's not like all women just sit around at home, you know, and are forced to stay inside and wear a burqa or, you know, something like a, you know, to think of like really, really, you know, modern day states with essentially gender apartheid. It's not like that. Obviously, women play active roles in society. But on the levels that Asha and Brienne are operating at, that's very rare. You know, women at that, you know, your job is to be a lady, you know, in all the senses of that word. And that's not their, they do not see that as their job. You know, they've obviously had very, very different levels of success and happiness with that. But that is how they look at their lives, and that's you know, they're much more interesting than just like, oh, she's a woman, but she kicks ass. You know, there's a lot more going on for both of them.
I think you're stuck into a sensitive topic here, because it is not exactly a gender thing per se. You rightly said that this issue about career and self-fulfillment isn't something that affects the common people, because they have to make a living. They simply can't choose about what they want to do and what they have to do. It is pretty much laid out for them. If you are born a peasant, you have certain duties, and they don't change, and they are not really subject to gender that much. That doesn't really play into it. These are pragmatic decisions. For example, if you are a pregnant woman, you obviously can't work the field, so you do the housework, so you come up with these solutions and with these roles more of pragmatic sensibilities. It is more a problem in the nobility. But there, as we had in the beginning of the podcast, we also have a problem on the male side of things, because this kind of career, so to speak, that Brienne and Asha are following is also not a path open to men. If you are a male noble, you have to become a knight, basically, if you are not the heir to a house or choose the path of maester or something. So if you would want to follow a profession like being a lady, a companion or something like that, you would really have to fight an uphill battle.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So I wouldn't reduce this to a gender aspect. It is a thing with society as a whole, that you attribute certain roles with a gender.
Right.
And this cuts both sides.
Yes.
It is perceived as an issue that favors men, and to a certain degree it is, because they hold most of the power compared to women. But if you would be a man who doesn't want this power and the role it is associated with, this doesn't help you nothing. So you would still face the same problem. And Asha and Brienne, they are just two female persons who rebel against these kinds of expectations from society. And I think we have yet to see a male character really turning on this order and trying to do the different thing. And I would go out of the woods here and predict that we won't see one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just one half sentence, because it is not an issue that is regarded as such, mostly.
Yeah. Yeah, unless you count Sam, you know, who, well, it's not like he was making a conscious choice, that just the way he is. Yeah, you don't really, male nobles in Westeros are powerless to not accept power. You know what I mean? Like, they must wield power. They can't choose to do.
Yeah, they must play the Game of Thrones. They have no choice.
Right. final question. Who would win in a fight, Brienne or Asha?
Is that the promise?
That was my, yes, I promised the ladies and gentlemen listening at home, I promised Steph and I had a funny question to ask him at the end, but I kept it a surprise because I wanted to catch him off guard.
Who would win a fight? Well, that's a very difficult question. I guess much comes down to the surroundings. If it is a very staged fight, like in a tourney melee or something, Brienne would have natural advantages that also in gear. I mean, she is normally armored to the teeth.
Right.
So Asha in her boiled leather would have certain problems getting at her and be chopped to pieces. But in such a battle as we see in A Dance with Dragons in the woods, where it is chaotic and it comes down to really throwing your opponent down with your pure force, I guess it would be evened out.
Yeah,
The thing is, Brienne doesn't really enjoy the fighting like Asha does.
Right.
So I would give Asha the edge if Brienne is not really invested in the fight. We see her fight in situations, Brienne, I mean, where she is really on the edge. The journey in Renly's camp, in which she wants to prove something, and then she fights for her life against the Brotherhood Without Banners and the remnants of the Bloody Mummers. And these are all high-stakes situations. And I guess if Asha would catch her in one of these situations, she would be pretty fucked. If it is a quote-unquote normal fight, I guess it would be more even.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Asha, in a sort of guerrilla situation. I like Asha, obviously, at sea. And Asha has a lot more experience and just sort of more zeal for it. Brienne has held her own in some pretty sticky circumstances, outnumbered and... against Jaime, who was handicapped at the time, but still, you still get the sense that there's maybe 10 dudes in all of Westeros who could beat Jaime even when Jaime's is handcuffed, right? That seems pretty clear. That he's still just so formidable that it really is genuinely impressive to not just get killed by him almost instantly, let alone to essentially have defeated him. So,
I think my money would be on Brienne.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, in the end, it also comes down to reach, and you have to be, a real master strategist to, outfight somebody, who's as big as a Brienne or Sandor or Robert or, God knows Gregor. Gregor is also as dumb as a bag of hammers, so that's how Oberyn manages to, to get his get the spear in there. But, Brienne's not stupid. So I just think ultimately her size and her skill probably give her the edge, so...
Yeah, Asha also has no experience in fighting knights,
right?
And Brienne has experience in chopping down men at arms, which Asha basically is.
Yeah.
So I really guess she would win.
Well, I'm glad that we ended our high-minded discussion of these two, very interesting and unusual women with figuring out who would win in a fight. Maybe next phone call we can end with whether the Hulk could beat Superman.
Yeah. I think Superman wins. Unless the Hulk is kryptonite. I mean, he's green.
See, I think the Hulk wins because the Hulk is the strongest one there is. I don't know how you argue with that. I'm sorry, but...
One dude can fly?
Oh, well, okay. That's what Hulk can jump. All right, you know what? Let's end this before it gets ugly.
okay.
All right, well, thanks everybody for listening. It's really good to be back. Stefan, it's great to talk to you as always.
Yeah, thanks. Right at your back.
And we'll see everybody next time.
Yeah, bye.
Bye-bye.